Good afternoon, it's Mountain Edition. All the week's news from the Roaring Fork Valley coming at you in the next half hour. I'm Kristen Kay.
And I'm Allison Bechtesh. Aspen officials are planning for a dry summer and have started to cut back on water consumption.
Local groups are working to prevent backcountry tragedies this summer.
We hear from a Dutch wildlife artist who finds inspiration in the Roaring Fork Valley.
And the community can create beauty out of broken objects for a new public art project.
The biggest stories from this week coming up on Mountain Edition. Earlier this month, Aspen City Council declared a stage one drought. This means the city is asking residents to voluntarily cut back on irrigation and water consumption and is requiring that city government do the same. Elizabeth Stewart-Severy has the details on how Aspen is working to conserve water.
A stage one drought in Aspen comes with a goal of reducing the use of water by 10% across the city. For the Parks Department, the first step was to eliminate one day of watering each week in most city parks. Operations manager Matt Kuhn says this will mean an immediate 15% reduction from last year. On top of that, he says, the city is working on an audit of its irrigation systems and had plans to improve efficiency even before the restrictions went into place.
We recognize that we could be more efficient in some ways, and a lot of our irrigation staff was driving those changes.
That includes updating sprinkler heads and installing weather stations at some parks to adapt watering schedules to weather conditions. Kuhn says the city is also hoping to cut back on the amount of time each park is watered by about 15% throughout the summer. The Aspen Golf Course is also required to reduce water consumption. Director of Golf Steve Aitken says they are watering at a reduced rate, which has saved 600,000 gallons in the past week. The last time the city implemented Stage 1 water restrictions was 2012. Elizabeth Stewart-Severy, Aspen Public Radio Environment Desk.
Governor John Hickenlooper has signed a bill reauthorizing the Colorado Civil Rights Commission. As Benta Berkland reports, the proposal was decided on the final day of the legislative session.
The commission handles civil rights cases. It was up for a review, and initially both Republicans and Democrats disagreed on how it should look. Democrats didn't want to make any changes, while Republicans had a number of requests, including altering the number of members and how they were chosen. The final version that the governor signed would not allow any political party to hold the majority of members on the commission, and the governor would still make appointments. But if the Senate rejected a nominee, that person would be banned from being nominated again for 2 years. I'm Benta Berkland.
The community is invited to help create a mosaic picnic table for the Latino Folk Art Garden on the Rio Grande Trail in Carbondale.
Shannon Muse has been a mosaic artist for nearly three decades.
Some of these are already pre-made, so we'll be able to recycle those.
She'll be heading up the creation of the table. She says that mosaic, which involves piecing together broken glass and tile to create images, is the perfect art form for a community project.
I like the metaphor of a lot of small parts making up a bigger whole product. I think that's really a fun way to think about human beings and society.
Muse says that kids and beginning artists can feel comfortable chipping in because there are no mistakes.
It's mosaic. If you break it in a way that you don't like, it doesn't matter. We'll still use it. Sometimes that's a plus.
Work sessions start today at Paradise Art Glass in Carbondale. They'll take place on Thursdays and Saturdays until the completion of the picnic table at the end of June. The project will then live in the Latino Folk Art Garden on the Rio Grande Trail.
Last week, the Wilderness Workshop announced that Executive Director Sloan Shoemaker was stepping down after 21 years with the conservation organization. Will Rausch, who has been with Wilderness Workshop since 2009, will be stepping into the position. Elizabeth Stewart-Severy spoke with Shoemaker and Rausch about the transition.
Sloan, the mission of the Wilderness Workshop is to protect and conserve the wilderness of the Roaring Fork Valley watershed and the White River National Forest. How do you gauge your success over the past 20 years? What are some key accomplishments you can point to?
Most recently, perhaps the greatest conservation victory, but they're all temporary, frankly, is the Thompson Divide. It hasn't been drilled. We started this campaign 10, 12 years ago, and it was seemingly under imminent threat and still hasn't been drilled. Other wins, like stopping some timber sales, getting some really positive outcomes on the travel management plan, getting some great designations in the forest plan.
So then what is left to be finished?
Well, there are more lands in the region that warrant wilderness designation, but that ain't happening in this political environment.
What are some of those places that you would mark?
Well, in Eagle County, there's some places north of the town of Eagle, like Castle Peak and Bull Gulch and Pisgah Mountain are wonderful areas that are wilderness study areas that qualify completely and have gotten lots of local support. There's the Assignation Ridge area outside of Carbondale, which the Forest Service designated as a recommended wilderness area. It's being managed as wilderness right now until Congress can act.
I might add to that and say we're closer than some folks might think in the Vail and Breckenridge area. We've got a public lands bill that would protect 100,000 acres. It's been introduced in the Senate and the House. And so we're closer to that than we've ever been. But Sloan's right. We've still got a ways to go.
Yeah, exactly.
And Will, as conservation director, you've worked on a lot of these projects. What will you prioritize as you prepare to step into the executive director position?
I don't think folks should be prepared for a radical change in the organization. We're going to keep our focus on public lands and particularly the public lands around the Roaring Fork Valley and kind of the West Slope of Colorado. I think we'll continue to prioritize protecting our communities from oil and gas development. We'll continue really focusing on protecting habitat at kind of the core of our mission, and whether that means working on forestry issues, stopping timber sales or changing them, taking on some of the challenges around recreation, those will all remain kind of key issues for us.
So, Will, Wilderness Workshop is an environmental conservation organization. I'm wondering if there are groups or organizations whose voices haven't been heard in some of these conversations. Are there places that you're looking to kind of expand Wilderness Workshop's reach?
Absolutely. Probably two ways to think about that. One is geographically. We're starting to do more work in the Eagle and Vail Valleys to protect habitat over there, expand connectivity, and work on wilderness. And then also, in terms of folks who haven't been reached, we're launching a Latino outreach program called Defiende with a party actually on June 2nd. And a series of hikes this summer. And so we really want to reach out to that community and make sure we're listening to what public lands issues are important to them and that we're engaging with them more than our community or organization has in the past.
Thank you both so much for being here.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
That was Will Rausch and Sloan Shoemaker of the Wilderness Workshop. In September, Rausch will take over as executive director as Shoemaker steps down. You can hear more of our conversation, including discussion of how federal policies impact local conservation work, on our website, aspenpublicradio.org.
You're listening to Mountain Edition from Aspen Public Radio News. I'm Kristen Kay.
And I'm Allison Bektesh. And Kristen, obviously, if people are listening to Mountain Edition, they want to be informed about local news.
Absolutely. One of the ways they can do this is by visiting Aspen Public Radio's Facebook page. While you're there, don't hesitate to like it.
There, you can interact with our station through comments on our posts and by messaging us directly.
This week, you can also see artist Melanie Walker at her exhibit in Anderson Ranch. It involves puppets. That's all I'll say.
Check it out by liking Aspen Public Radio on Facebook.
If an oil and gas company pays too much in tax, it can get a refund called an abatement. Garfield County might see one or two of these each year, and it's the libraries, hospitals, and school districts, among others, who refund the money. Because it's money they count on, it can be painful to let go of, and even more painful if they're asked to pay interest, too. Wyatt Orm reports.
Amy Shipley can think about $20,000 in a couple of ways.
Half a person or 10,000 books.
She's the interim executive director of Garfield County Libraries. And by half a person, she means a part-time employee. $20,000, Shipley says, can mean a lot to a library.
Every little bit counts.
$20,000 is just the interest they're being asked to pay on top of a much larger bill. Before going further, let's talk about property tax, specifically how the taxes homeowners pay differ from those the oil and gas industry pays. If you own a home, the amount of property tax you pay depends on your home's worth. And you don't decide that number. In Garfield County, at least, Jim Yellico does. He's the county assessor.
My office values property. That's our job.
Oil and gas is different because they tell him how much their property is worth. Those numbers usually have lots of zeros.
We're not talking about a $500,000 house. We're talking about $700 million in value.
So if oil and gas pays too much property tax, it's because they've said their property is worth more than it actually is. Now, mistakes happen. So when companies make accounting errors and realize they've paid too much in tax, they can ask for their money back. This is what happened in 2016. The company Encana asked Garfield County to return nearly $6 million. Caris, another company, a little over $1 million. Encana, who no longer operates in Colorado, also wanted to be paid $850,000 in interest. Amy Shipley of the Garfield County Libraries doesn't think this is fair.
Why are they able to gather interest when it was a mistake that they made?
The libraries will refund Encana and Caris a total of $140,000. They owe Encana $20,000 in interest. And it's not just the libraries, either. Grand River Hospital in Rifle owes Encana over $100,000 in interest. Garfield County has said it'll pick up the bill on Encana's interest. The special districts, like the libraries and hospital, still need to pay the refunds or abatements. But the question still remains, what's to stop the oil and gas companies from overpaying taxes, knowing they'll get all their money back and then some?
Morals.
Garfield County Assessor Jim Yellico again. It's not that oil and gas companies don't have morals, he says.
The oil and gas companies in Garfield County are very good neighbors.
After all, half of the property tax coming to the county is paid by the oil and gas industry. Still, Yellico does not think the industry should profit from paying the wrong amount of tax, seeing that they report their own value. He's not the only one.
You know, I do think that everybody believes we need to change this.
Bob Rankin is a Republican who represents Garfield, Moffat, and Rio Blanco counties in the state legislature. He introduced a bill last session prohibiting companies from charging interest on property tax abatements. The session ended before the bill went anywhere, but Rankin plans to bring it up again next year. Neither Encana nor Caris agreed to an interview for this story. Dan Haley, the vice president of the Colorado Oil and Gas Association, said via email that it's important business and government are treated equally, and that, quote, the application of interest swings both ways. The industry does have to pay interest in other scenarios, like if the assessor finds a company has underreported their property values during an audit. But Jim Yellico says in that case, the companies pay interest because they didn't do their taxes right. That's not the same as receiving interest for not doing their taxes right. After all, Yellico says,
interest is a penalty, and that's a fact.
And if the system doesn't change, the penalty could continue to fall on libraries and school districts for a mistake that's not theirs. Wyatt Orm, Aspen Public Radio News.
After 9 deaths in the Elk Mountain backcountry last summer, Mountain Rescue Aspen wanted change. The organization has teamed up with the Picken County Sheriff's Office and the U.S. Forest Service on a new campaign aimed at helping prepare people for backcountry adventures. Elizabeth Stewart-Severy has the story.
Dispatch, is your call an emergency?
Yes, I just got a text that said, need help. I'm on the backside of K2. I got way off the trail.
Toward the end of last summer, phone calls like this were much too common. Someone is stuck on a high peak, or a friend went to climb a 14er and hasn't made it back down. Calls like this kick off many backcountry rescue missions, where local volunteers head into the mountains to help those in need. And last summer, they say, there were far too many of them. 74 rescue missions and 9 body recoveries in the Elk Range. All those involved agree, it was tough.
It felt like on a weekly basis, we were getting another tragic report of another fatality.
It just seemed overwhelming.
It was wearing on us.
And it wasn't just the deaths, it was the overall accumulation of rescues.
Mountain Rescue Aspen is teaming up with the Forest Service and the Sheriff's Office, hoping to prevent another year like this. They've put together a peak awareness series to introduce mountaineering skills for those interested in climbing challenging peaks. Because as Sheriff Joe DeSalvo points out,
these are not casual day hikes. These are technical ascents. And I'm also certainly not afraid to say that this will kill you when you get up there and you realize that you're open your head, it can kill you.
Karen Schroyer is the Forest Service District Ranger for the Aspen Soperus area. These mountains have long attracted visitors from across the state and the country, but she says that at least one current trend is concerning.
There are just so many folks that are coming to the Elk Mountain Range that just aren't as prepared as they need to be.
Justin Hood is president of Mountain Rescue Aspen. The volunteer group has worked with local mountain guides to put together a course to help people prepare for backcountry adventures. It will be offered 8 times, 6 evenings on the Front Range and twice in the Roaring Fork Valley. The presentation covers things like what to bring for a day in the high peaks, what's known as the 10 essentials. These are the supplies that all climbers should carry, like navigation tools and a first aid kit that can help you improvise if something goes wrong. They'll also look at case studies and talk about best practices. Hood says the idea here is to be sure that people are headed into the mountains armed with knowledge.
You don't know what's coming your way, but you're able to make your own informative decisions based upon how you set yourself up for success.
There will also be 8 day-long field courses, complete with skills clinics, taught throughout the summer and subsidized by the 3 organizations. These will focus on technical skills and navigation for those looking to climb challenging 14ers. Mountain Rescue will also offer a summer workshop that covers more general backcountry skills. All of this is intended to catch and educate people before they get to the trailhead, and the focus is certainly on safety. But District Ranger Schroyer says it's also about protecting the forest from heavy impacts. People who are less prepared tend to do more damage, she says, and rescues can be tough on these areas.
To see the number of helicopter rescues that are having to be made in congressionally designated wilderness is tough to watch as well.
The education effort comes after months of discussions about how to prevent future tragedies. In the wake of 5 deaths on Capitol Peak, some concerned citizens suggested adding signs to mark the route. But Schroyer says this is not going to happen next summer. Instead, she says the focus is on building skills.
What works better than signs that could possibly come down or possibly be moved is a good sense of how to use a map and a compass.
Hood agrees that a strong skill base is essential and that ultimately safety in the high peaks is about decision making.
You have to make the appropriate choices for you and be willing to turn around at any point in time if it's not working right.
Hood says the courses and clinics offered this summer are in part aimed at beginners, but he also hopes that this series will bring together people with a wide range of experience.
Nobody's invincible here.
But he hopes the courses offer a proactive way to save more lives well before the 911 calls come in. Elizabeth Stewart Severy, Aspen Public Radio Environment Desk.
This is Mountain Edition on Aspen Public Radio. I'm Kristen Kay.
And I'm Allison Bechtesh. In other news, a new exhibit in Snowmass uses photography and sculpture to ask audiences to see in a new way.
Local officials want more people to enjoy Pitkin County's Whitewater Park and have a plan up their sleeve.
Aspen officials had a conversation this week about the well-stocked bank account of the Wheeler Opera House.
And a group hoping to change Aspen's election date is seeking public feedback on their efforts.
Those stories and more news are on our website now. Take a listen at aspenpublicradio.org.
Greg Trinish is the founder and executive director of Adventure Scientists. He'll be in Aspen this June speaking as a part of the Aspen Institute's Spotlight Health Conference. Allison spoke with Trinish about his organization, which works to improve the environment based on data collected by volunteers worldwide.
Your organization is very data-driven. What types of data are you collecting?
Yeah, so it's really anything that you can collect from the outdoors. We've got people collecting everything from scat samples from animals that are being used to look at antibiotic resistant strands of bacteria, all the way through we've got people that are catching butterflies and taking photos of them to help the Forest Service manage remote areas and look at biodiversity in remote areas. So it really runs the gamut. For us, it's anything where there's a collection of any kind or where there's a deployment of some kind of instrument, like a remotely triggered camera, or we might be using what's called an X-ray fluorescence machine, which allows you to zap a laser beam at a rock and instantly get a reading as to what minerals are in that rock. So it really is a large array of data that we collect, but it's got to be from the outdoors. For us, if we're going to actually take on the project, there has to be a clear need for an outdoor skill set to get to a place and collect the data that's needed.
What are you up against every time you get brought on as the consultant, the data arm of a project? Are you having to deal with governments throughout the world? What's your biggest challenge?
Yeah, we have so many challenges, but that's the fun part, is figuring out how to work through those. Permitting is always a challenge. Anytime we're transporting biological materials, that always comes into play. When you're dealing with transporting plant materials or transporting insects or whatever it is, it can get really tricky. You know, we are creating new protocols for each project, and we're trying to make sure that our volunteers are going to be really successful. Again, through more than 130 of these projects, we've become experts at making sure that the data are going to be trustworthy and are really going to be used in the ways that we want them to. So one of my favorite projects that I'm really excited about is a timber project that we have right now. It's focused on creating genetic reference libraries of commercially viable trees. So what that means is we're starting with big leaf maple this year, and big leaf maple is super important for guitars. And who knew? I had no idea this was the case, but they can fetch $20,000, $30,000, or even $40,000 a guitar because of what's called the flaming or the patterns in the wood. And so it gets illegally poached all the time. And so what we're doing is we're creating these genetic reference libraries so that you can distinguish the genetics of bigleaf maple between the trees that are grown in San Diego, the ones that are further up the coast in San Francisco, et cetera, et cetera. And with that in place, it'll be possible to zap an incoming timber shipment and instantly know where it came from and therefore whether it was legally or illegally harvested. And if that works out and we're able to do that, what an incredible tool, not just for port officials on both sides of timber trade. It's an incredible tool for the buyers and suppliers of timber and lumber at furniture stores around the globe or hardware stores. And it's an incredible tool someday for consumers to be able to have their own ability to make sure that they're making purchases of legally sourced timber. I think that's such an incredible way that we're able to create this new tool or this new mechanism to combat an issue, rather than relying on governments, relying on anybody really to implement the solutions.
That was Greg Trinish, founder and executive director of Adventure Scientists, speaking with Allison. Tune in to Spotlight Health on Aspen Public Radio on Tuesdays at 3:30 to hear more from researchers working to improve the health of the planet.
Wout de Groot is a Dutch wildlife painter. He lives in Eckman on Sea, a coastal village in northern Netherlands. However, his works are widely exhibited in Western art shows and galleries throughout Colorado, Nevada, and Utah. He was in Basalt recently, where Kristen met up with him to talk about what inspires him in the natural settings of the Roaring Fork Valley.
Wout de Groot looks like he would be at home hiking on Arbony Kittle or fishing on the Frying Pan. He's tan and dressed casually in outdoorsy clothes, jeans and hiking boots. When I meet him, I ask him to pronounce his name. He does, and then he tells me what it means.
Woody the Great.
Woody the Great.
That's hard to live up to.
It's just a silly name.
De Groot doesn't just try to live up to expectations. He challenges them. His work blurs the line between traditional and modern painting. We look at his pieces in a gallery, and he explains that the realism of his subjects, often waterfowl and other animals, contrasts with his abstract backgrounds.
What I'm seeking is the mythical qualities in nature. You know, when I, for example, see raven flying, I mean, that for me, that's a mythical You know, I used to illustrate also bird guides, and that's a very scientific way of looking at them. And I got bored of that because I don't see them just like that. So I'm trying to create a kind of atmosphere, you know, how the way I feel how that particular mammal or bird or whatever is in its environment.
De Groot and I take a walk beside the Roaring Fork River. I ask him what about his work appeals to audiences in the American West. He says that his pieces have a bit of frontier spirit.
I'm not a real traditional painter, although I can paint 100% perfectly realistic if I want. But I do get a really little bored with just doing that, so I'll mix those two different worlds, art types up, and create my own atmosphere, my own space, environment.
It's a beautiful spring morning. I see the water and I see the green leaves on the trees, but as a painter and as someone who mixes kind of this abstract approach with a realistic approach, can you tell me what you see?
Well, I see running water, and that's something always fascinates me because it's like you can just see it. The light, the glistening of the water, and that's what I often pursue in my paintings, you know. This is very inspirational place.
Can you tell me, how does this compare with your hometown, where you're from and where you paint?
It is completely different, you know. I grew up in a small, it was an old fishing village. We were always outside, you know, so. But that's similar. It's always like, it's light, the sun, and water. I mean, endless inspiration.
So yeah. Your subjects, yeah. You do paint mammals, but really you focus on birds.
Yeah.
And I think that takes a certain eye and a certain person to appreciate birds. So why birds?
Yeah, well, I grew up with birds, you know. We, for example, you know, down in the Netherlands, we do not have big wild mammals like bison or elk or whatever, you know. Yeah, mm-hmm. You can find maybe some deer and stuff, but you need to go more to like the German border. So it was always birds to me, as a kid already, you know. I was drawing birds, you know, when I was 5 years old.
Are you painting while you're here?
I'm just getting lots of inspiration. I'm fishing. I'm fly fishing, you know. Yesterday I went out with two guys to the frying pan, and the wildlife out there with birds, all the different warblers and the cardinals, and it was amazing. There was even an osprey who grabbed a trout from the river. I mean, I can enjoy that just as much, just to, you know, trying to get that monster brown trout.
Do you have anything specific that you have in your head that you'll get down when you go home?
I'm going to do something with the ospreys. I think I will be doing, you know, something like an osprey getting out of the water, you know, with a trout in his leg, something like that. Yeah.
We'll be looking for that.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for taking the time.
Yeah, well, thank you.
That was Dutch wildlife painter Avoud De Groot speaking with Kristen. De Groot's work will be featured in the Western Waters exhibit, opening later this summer at the Ann Korologos Gallery.
That's all for Mountain Edition this week. I'm Kristen Kay.
And I'm Allison Bechtesh. You can find more news from the Roaring Fork Valley and from all around the world on our website, aspenpublicradio.org.
Join us tomorrow at 3:30 for Valley Roundup. Allison takes a deep dive beyond the headlines with a panel of local reporters and editors. And Allison, I understand it's kind of a special week for Valley Roundup.
It is. All housing is the topic of Valley Roundup this week, featuring Bill Sterling, a former mayor of Aspen, who recently wrote an op-ed about housing in both papers.
Always a hot topic in the Roaring Fork Valley. Thanks for listening. Mountain Edition is a production of Aspen Public Radio News.